Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger here on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Even before he was elected, Arnold Schwarzenegger turned to Terry Tamminen, an advisor from the nonprofit sector on the environment, to format his new energy policy and climate change policy for the state of California. Terry Tamminen was then appointed as the new director of the California EPA and went on to become a cabinet advisor to Governor Schwarzenegger. He has since been to British Columbia to advise Premier Gordon Campbell. Today we're going to hear his speech that was given at the Vancouver Museum April 4th, 2007.
So welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the book launch and celebration of Lives Per Gallon, True Cost of Our Oil Addiction. My name is Tim Drayman. I'm the Executive Director of Tides Canada Foundation. And it's my real honor tonight to introduce the author of Lives Per Gallon, Terry Tamminen. But before I do that, I'd just like to thank some people who made this evening possible. First on that list, I'd like to thank Mike McGee and Convergence Communications. It's the work that Mike has been doing on building government plans for controlling greenhouse gases and developing a climate action plan that linked us in this period of time with Terry and the opportunity for Terry to be here tonight. I'd also like to thank sponsors of the evening, who include Van City, James Hogan and Associates, David Suzuki Foundation, Westport Innovations, Happy Planet, and Tides Canada Foundation. Well, we are really privileged tonight to have Terry Tamminen with us. When I was preparing for my introduction for Terry tonight and going over his curriculum vitae and the number of hits he has on Google, I was really struck by the fact that Terry, in many ways, is a 21st century Renaissance person. This is somebody who's been a farmer, a businessman, an educator, a nonprofit leader, an environmentalist, and a very senior public official. But really, as important as all those things are, he's also somebody who's been a remarkably sagacious public policy innovator. And that is really going to be a big part of what we're going to be talking about tonight and the subject of his book, How to Bring About Change through Public Policy. Terry has done a remarkable number of things in his life. He's managed the largest sheep ranch west of the Mississippi in the United States. In developing new methods of livestock disease control, he's worked in West Africa and Nigeria, helping that country create their first solid waste recycling program. He's an avid airplane and helicopter pilot. He speaks German, Dutch, and Spanish. As an environmentalist, he founded the Santa Monica Baykeeper and served for 6 years as its ED. He also co-founded waterkeeper programs in San Diego, Orange County, Ventura, and Santa Barbara. For 5 years, he was the executive director of the Environment Now Foundation in Santa Monica, California, and he co-founded the Frank G. Wells Environmental Law Clinic at the School of Law, University of California, Los Angeles. He advises or sits on a wide array of boards, including Stanford School of Law's Environmental Law Clinic, the Consultative Group on Biodiversity, the Environmental Grantmakers Association, the Energy Independence Now Coalition, and Southern California Coastal Wetlands Recovery Project. You can see why, after having done all those kinds of things, that Terry would be honored with things like the Solar Champion 2006 Award, the Recycling Leader of the Year, the Clean Air Leadership Award, and Visionary Leadership Award, to mention just a few. But perhaps most interesting from the point of view of our time with Terry tonight is the fact that he worked with Arnold Schwarzenegger before he ran for governor to help him put together his policy platform. And he was appointed as Secretary of the California Environmental Protection Agency by Governor Schwarzenegger in November 2003 and later became Cabinet Secretary and Chief Policy Advisor to the Governor in December 2004. He's no longer the head of the California Environmental Protection Agency, but he continues to advise the governor on energy and environmental policy, and he currently travels the United States and the world lecturing and providing private consulting services to a variety of clients, including several governors and Canadian premiers on climate change and energy policy. And interestingly, and I hope there are questions about this tonight, he's also advising Premier Campbell on climate change. So I want to take this opportunity to welcome Terry with us tonight, and we're going to have a schedule that'll be Terry's going to speak and read for about an hour, and then we'll have a question period after that. So please think about those questions while Terry is doing his presentation to you. So please join with me in welcoming Terry Tamminen.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks very much. Thanks to all of you for being here. What a great group, a lot of familiar faces, and thank you so much for being here tonight and to Tides Canada for hosting this. That was a very kind introduction, but I have to tell you, the Times of London, the newspaper, during the American Civil War, they had a correspondent in New York who was sending back to them the lurid tales from the American Civil War. They couldn't believe that what they were reading was true. You can imagine in very proper Britain that they couldn't imagine what they were hearing from the American Civil War. But, of course, in those days, there was no electronic communication. There was no way to verify whether or not any of this was accurate. So they felt nonetheless compelled, on the chance that it was, that they should print it. So, and this is a very true story. If you look at the Times of London from the 1860s, you'll see all of these lurid tales from the American Civil War printed in the paper under the banner, "Important if True." And so it is with my bio. But thank you anyway. And I really do want to thank Tides. As we're going to talk about tonight, there really is this moment in time when the people in this room and a few people like you will solve global warming or not. And obviously, it's a train that's left the station to some degree. We're already suffering some of its impacts, and we will continue to suffer others. But we can contain that. We can limit the damage to things that we can still reasonably deal with and control and pay for. Or it can get completely out of control, and it will impact the quality of our lives and the lives of our children and their children. And it's the Tides Foundation that I think is uniquely suited to help guide some of the funders, including from the United States, who have come to them for advice about how can we play an active role in helping Canada with its environmental goals, and particularly here in British Columbia, but throughout Canada. And I just want to applaud them and thank them for doing things like this, for being thoughtful, for being nonpartisan, and just coming together and bringing people together and solving problems. I have great admiration for what Tides and Mike and the whole team is doing. So please thank Tim and Mike and everybody. As Tim said, I was running an environmental foundation, and Arnold, who I'd known for some time, called me up and he said, "Look, I'm going to run for governor. I want to be the greenest governor in the history of California. So let's work on an environmental action plan." So we spent days and days doing it and went ahead and gave it out to the press, and everyone was kind of shocked that, this bodybuilder He-Man guy, let alone a Republican, could come up with something like this. And everyone said, "Oh, well, would he really do it? I mean, you got to be kidding," and so forth. And so the day of the election comes, and he gets elected, and the next day I go into his office, and I rather smugly said, "Well, Arnold, I don't know if you have any idea what you've just bitten off, but at least you have a terrific environmental action plan to execute." And without missing a beat, he said, "No, I don't. You do." And it was truly the first moment that I had thought about going up to Sacramento and serving. I kind of thought, "Hey, pal, good luck. Go have fun. I'll see you in 4 years." So obviously presented with that opportunity, what are you going to do? You spend your life and your career trying to improve the environment, trying to fight these battles, and suddenly a guy gives you the keys to the kingdom. So you got to give up your life. It's kind of like in America going into the Peace Corps. You just give up your life, you go for a few years, and you come home. And I still haven't come home, even though I've officially left state government, because now, as Tim said, I'm going out and going around the country and into other countries, obviously, and talking about climate change and policies, and not just California's policies, but but those of other states and nations, and how we can learn from those so that we can more rapidly adapt them in other places, and especially in places like the United States and Canada, where our federal governments have let us down, but where our state and provincial governments and city governments can actually take bold action and, I believe, solve this problem within a generation, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. But first, let me frame my remarks to you, and as Tim said, I'll chat for a few minutes, and then we'll get into questions and answers and comments, because I think that's probably the most productive way to spend our time together tonight. And then, believe it or not, I'll actually sit over there and sign some books if you want to buy them. So we'll enjoy our time together. But let me frame my remarks to you tonight in the form of a question. For what will we remember this day? Most of our days go by in very unremarkable fashion. It's hard to remember what we did last Wednesday or a year ago last Wednesday. But some days are days when our lives are changed or when we choose to change them. We all remember the day we were married or the day we found out there was no Santa Claus. We remember the birth of our first child or the death of JFK. We remember a favored graduation or the day we were sworn into the cabinet of an Austrian movie star bodybuilder governor. Common occurrence. And if we are of a certain age, we remember December 7th, 1941. And no matter what our age, we all remember 9/11, the other date that will live in infamy. But for what will we remember this day? Will this be one of those days when our lives are changed or when we choose to change them? And I want to suggest to you tonight a way that we can walk out of here making this one of those days to remember. But before I do that, and I'm going to read a little bit from the book to illustrate this, before I do that, let me share with you, if I may, just a couple of those days to remember in my own life that led me down this path of environmental advocacy and ultimately into government to try to put those ideas into action. One of them was meeting a Hopi elder. Now, the Hopi are a tribe of Native Americans in Arizona. An elder by the name of Vernon Masayasva. He was the chairman of the Hopi tribe at that time. And I was really curious as I got to know Vernon and the tribe a little bit more and was working with them on a coal mining issue in their territory and a water issue in their territories. I was really curious how it was that they have lived sustainably in one of the most stingy environments on the planet. If any of you have ever been to Arizona, especially out to those three mesas, you know what life is like out there. And yet archaeologists tell us that the dwellings on those three mesas are the longest continuously occupied dwellings in the world, longer than Egypt, longer than anywhere else on the planet, tens of thousands of years of continuous occupation and a sustainable lifestyle and a sustainable society. And I was very curious, given the challenges we face, how is it that a society that has grown up, and I mean, they don't exactly live in mud huts anymore, these are now, you know, fully functional homes like anyone else would enjoy having, and how is it that they've done that? And it's very hard to really convey to you all of the ways that the Hopi live in order to be sustainable, but let me share with you just two elements that maybe best express it. The first is that the Hopi have no word for wilderness. To them, there's no such thing as wilderness. It's only the places where they raise their families and their food and where they live and they have their sustenance. But they do have a word for wild, meaning crazy person. And to them, a wild or crazy person is someone who would harm what we call wilderness. The second thing that tells you a great deal about the Hopi is that when they sit down to a meal, they say, Kwakwakitam Nunusa, which means, thank you, we have eaten. Now, they don't just mean the we at the table who are eating at that moment. They mean the cook who made the food that had to eat, the farmer that grew the crops, our ancestors who gave birth to the farmer and to the cook and to us that we might be here today eating. All of those things had to eat that we might be eating today. And in fact, the food itself had to be nourished by the wind and the rain and the land. And so they never want to forget that connectedness to all the things that had to eat that they might be eating today. So they say, thank you, we have eaten. And they know that if you break any one of those strands, that food would not be on the table today. They would not be living sustainably. And I find these lessons very interesting because, especially when Governor Schwarzenegger was elected and I was tasked with going up there with him and implementing his environmental action plan, I said to myself, well, are we going to follow the path of the Hopi? Does California in particular, let alone the rest of the United States or the world, are we living as sustainably as the Hopi? Now, by contrast, another example, and I talk about this in the book too, a second day in my life that was a day to remember was meeting another very interesting person, a woman by the name of Joanne Van Tilburg. Joanne was the archaeologist who figured out what happened to the society on Easter Island, Rapa Nui as it's actually called. And that's that desert speck of island in the Pacific off the coast of Chile that's home to those giant tiki-looking statues called moai, which weigh as much as 80 tons and are as much as 100 feet tall. And no one could figure out how an unmechanized society could carve these things out of rock and move them miles across the island with no machinery and no apparent way of moving them and no resources on this barren island. Well, Joanne and her team figured out that Easter Island, Rapa Nui, was not always barren. It was once a lush subtropical paradise. It was home to birds and biodiversity that was breathtaking. It had Chilean wine palms, which grow 80 feet tall and 10 feet in diameter, which would have made great canoes for going out and harvesting the bounty of the sea, but also apparently made great rollers to move those statues. It was home to an incredible abundance of plant and animal life. But the archaeologists figured out that within a couple of short generations of conspicuous consumption, 20,000 people on this tiny island in a very sophisticated society wiped out all of the natural resources, building statues and simply eating everything until there was nothing left. And so by the time Dutch explorers came to the island in the 1700s, instead of a robust, sophisticated society of 20,000, they found about 300 inhabitants left living in caves and resorting to cannibalism. Now, when you compare the Hopi and the residents of Easter Island, you're forced to say to yourself, well, how are we doing on this planet, this island in the middle of space? Are we doing the Hopi way or are we doing the Easter Island way? And that's a lot of what this book is about, and it's a lot about what I talk to other governors about when it comes to global warming, when it comes to how are we protecting or living with our nest, and what we're trying to pass on to the next generation. Sadly, I think most of you can answer this question for yourself. I'm guessing you wouldn't be here if you were not engaged in environmental issues, if you were not very aware of these issues, probably very aware of climate change, which, by the way, I compliment Canadians for being so much more aware and focused on climate change than Americans. The public opinion polling shows how highly you value that and how much you know about it, and I really wish I could clone your brains and take it down to America and teach the rest of the population. Somebody please tell me how to do that later. But it's truly this question, whether it's global warming, whether it's our dependence on fossil fuels, whether it's the way we use natural resources, it really does boil down to this question of, are we going to just continue to consume everything as the residents of Rapa Nui did until we end up with a lifestyle that we're not particularly happy with? I mean, we often talk about saving the planet. The planet doesn't care if we're here. 98% of all the plant and animal life that ever existed on the planet went extinct before the advent of industrial man. Species come and go all the time. The planet couldn't care if we are here. The question we really need to ask is, how can we save ourselves? How can we save our quality of life? And I'm not one of those people that says that we're all going to die off, that pollution or global warming is going to kill us. It's not about that. Not any more than all the residents of Rapa Nui died out. It's about the quality of life that we have and that we pass on to our children. That's really what we're fighting for here. So how are we doing when it comes to that? Well, I wrote this book, Lives Per Gallon, because when I look at the way we're consuming our natural resources, our land, our forests, our water, our oceans, our fisheries, our air, our climate, it seems to me that the greatest driving force that is pushing us in the direction of Easter Island and away from the sustainable path of the Hopi is oil and our dependence on oil and what it's done to us, especially in America, because we've now not only mortgaged our public health and our economy to oil, we've mortgaged our public policy and our reputation around the world. I don't think at this point there's anyone who doesn't think that the invasion of Iraq has at least something to do with protecting oil. Even President Bush, in a news conference, I talk about it in the book, about a year ago, he was asked what he was thinking in April of 2003 as he was preparing to launch the invasion of Iraq. What was he thinking about after the war, after the immediate surge of troops in Iraq? And he said, well, I was first thinking about protecting the oil infrastructure and the pipelines and the refineries. And then I was thinking about how many refugees there might be and what we would do with them. And then I was thinking about, well, we're going to have to get food in there for all the troops. That was his order of importance. So even President Bush has essentially admitted that that invasion and the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who have died and the thousands of Americans and other allied troops that have died were all about saving a nickel on a gallon of gasoline. So when I looked at this dynamic of oil, I was compelled to write this book and talk about, as it says, lives per gallon, whether it's in Iraq or in other ways, the true cost of our oil addiction. And it is an addiction, but it's an addiction that we have been powerless to overcome in the same way that smokers have been powerless to overcome the addiction to tobacco because of the manipulation of nicotine. And I want to talk about those facts directly from the book. But as I say, there is a cost to this oil addiction. Some of those costs can be quantified. I'll talk briefly about those. But some of them go far beyond our poor power to add or subtract. Let me read briefly from the book. Kids like me with asthma, during ozone days, I will almost always have an attack if I go outside, testified 8-year-old Kyle Dammitz in December 2002 at a U.S. EPA hearing on proposed diesel standards that would include reducing emissions from school buses. On good days, I take 2 pills in the morning and 3 pills at bedtime. I do an IV treatment every 2 weeks. On a bad asthma day, I take 4 pills in the morning and more at lunch and again more at bedtime. I came here today to ask you to help. If you make our air cleaner, I will be able to live longer. Cleaner air standards for diesel-powered buses and trucks were ultimately adopted by the U.S. EPA over the objection of the American Petroleum Institute and the engine and vehicle manufacturers. The vehicle and engine manufacturers and the Petroleum Institute objected to cleaning up their emissions from diesel, despite knowing that 100,000 Americans die every single year prematurely from completely preventable petroleum-related air pollution. And I'm sorry, I don't know the statistics for Canada, but I'll bet proportionally, depending on your population, it's the same. They objected despite the fact they knew that 6.5 million Americans go to the hospital every single year with asthma and other respiratory diseases that can now be attributed directly to petroleum-related air pollution. They objected despite knowing the studies that now show that a child who lives within a mile of a busy urban freeway loses as much as 1% of his or her lung function every single year. And this is in the richest country in the history of this planet. We can't even protect our children from the ravages of diesel emissions. And these lobbies continue to fight this. Well, how did they object to those standards for diesel particulate reduction? Did they just say, give us a little more time and we'll do it, or let's make it voluntary and we'll do it, or help us with the cost, maybe we need a little tax break or some incentive to do it and we'll take care of it? Well, let me read to you from the book again about exactly what they said about those standards. First comment came from the chair of the Automobile Alliance, which includes all the major automobile manufacturers around the world. He said the standards for ozone and particulate matter, there's no particular need to tighten these standards given the tremendous progress America has made in cleaning up our air. He said that despite knowing these statistics about how many people die and get sick. Oh, by the way, the person who was the chair of the Automobile Alliance in those days was a guy by the name of Andy Card, who then went on to become the chief of staff to President Bush. One of his colleagues who ran the American Petroleum Institute, Paul Bailey, he said, you know, it seems to me that the effects that are typically seen are very short-term and very reversible, and people exposed to ozone usually adapt to it. 100,000 deaths, yeah, I guess that's a form of adaptation. Richard Klimsch, another auto industry representative, he said, the effects of ozone are not that serious. What we're talking about is a temporary loss of lung function of 20 or 30%. That's not really a health effect. He went on to say that people can protect themselves. They can avoid jogging. Kids, asthmatic kids like Kyle, need not go out and ride their bikes. You see, they have heart. But I give credit to the oil industry lobbyist who was the most candid in saying that those statistics about the 100,000 people who die early every year, he didn't dispute them, but he said they shouldn't be counted because those were old people who were going to die anyway. That's what the auto and engine manufacturers and oil industry think about us. That's what they thought about when they objected to these standards that ultimately were passed over their objections and have resulted in thousands of reduced deaths and thousands of reduced cases of asthma. We have a long way to go, but it made a big difference.
You are listening to Terry Tamminen, the author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, on the local Brown Bagger, CFRO 102.7, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Now, those kinds of illnesses and that kind of callous behavior comes under the category of ways that we can't measure the true cost of our oil addiction. But it's not just our own communities that pay that unmeasurable price in terms of health care and lost productivity and early deaths and so forth. Sad to say, but there are a lot of people who pay this price for all of us that we will never meet. In third world countries, I talk about this in the book, I lived in Nigeria, I traveled extensively in South America, and I've seen firsthand how the oil companies go into a country, they destroy the landscape, there's bribes, there's very little environmental law, so they leave the tailings from their drillings and toxic waste from their drilling muds and so forth. They leave toxic pools of waste after they've extracted the oil, and they simply disappear. And people can no longer farm, can no longer live in these communities, certainly can't move away to a big city. People who don't even use mechanized transportation get no benefit from the oil that was taken out of their lands as their lands were destroyed. And they pay a terrible price for our oil addiction as well. Let me read one example to you from the book. Upstream from the Ecuadorian port of Esmeraldas, a 1998 landslide broke two major pipelines, sending oil and gas cascading down streets and into rivers. A spark set off an inferno, which devoured cars and homes. People were burned alive. Frantic parents put their children in wooden canoes and pushed them into the Esmeraldas River, and then watched in horror as fire engulfed the river and the children. Locals now call petroleum the excrement of the devil. The majority of the oil produced in Ecuador is exported to refineries in Los Angeles and San Francisco. Now, I don't know exactly where the crude oil comes from that ends up in your cars. I suspect some of it is from your local oil industry, but it's a worldwide industry. The chances are some of it is imported. And in any event, it's a worldwide use and worldwide network. So when we use a gallon of gasoline, we're all part of this. And lest you think this was just one tragic accident, because let's face it, accidents do occur. I've got quite a few of them in the book that are very much like this. And if you do some research, you'll find dozens and dozens and dozens more. Unfortunately, every time we pump a gallon of gas, we really need to think about these faceless, nameless people who are paying for our petroleum joyride, especially if it's a living room on wheels that takes us to the supermarket. So how did we get into this mess, especially in the United States? How did this happen? Because let's face it, the big auto companies, the big oil companies are American companies. You in Canada didn't create this problem. You unfortunately are suffering right along with the rest of us. How did we get into this mess? Well, there's two words that can answer that question. One is politics, and the other is lies. The politics are very simple. In the last decade, the oil and auto industry has spent $186 million on campaign contributions in Washington, D.C. for congressional and presidential campaigns. And you know what they got back for that? they got back $1,000 for every single dollar of that $186 million that they contributed in the form of tax breaks or other subsidies. I think if you could get $1,000 back for investing a dollar, you would keep doing it too. And what do those $1,000 for every hundred for that $186 million, what does that constitute? Well, $114 billion a year are spent on direct tax subsidies and other breaks to the oil and auto industries, the richest corporations in the history of commerce. They hardly need our charity. And yet in the United States alone, we're doling out over $100 billion a year in subsidies of one kind or another directly to these companies. And I know your tax laws and some of your laws here in Canada do the same thing, probably not on the same scale, but probably close. We also spend in the United States over $600 billion a year on health care costs. Those are all calculated health care costs that are included in the cost of our health insurance and in the cost of our government and our state governments and our federal government providing health care to the indigent and the elderly under our various health care programs in the United States. $600 billion a year that can be directly attributed to disease, illness, and death caused by completely preventable petroleum-related air pollution. And millions, billions and billions more on things that you might not even think about. We have studies in California in our farming communities that show that farmers lose as much as one-third of their crops every single year to petroleum-related air pollution. Think about what ozone does to our lungs. Well, a head of lettuce growing in the farmer's field near a busy freeway, even as the farmer is passing with his mechanized equipment, that smog, that ozone, that particulate matter does the same thing to that leafy vegetable as it does to our lungs. And the net result is the loss of as much as a third of a farmer's crop. We're stealing the food out of our own mouths because of our petroleum joyride. And then, of course, there's environmental cleanup, there's defense costs, and obviously the war in Iraq at this point, which in my totals in the book I don't even include. But if you take just the ongoing background defense of oil around the globe by the American government, all of this totals about $1 trillion a year in one kind of subsidy or another to the oil and auto industries. That works out to $2,700 for every man, woman, and child in America. It's enough to provide health insurance to the 45 million Americans who have none and to build 1,500 schools in every state in the nation every single year. And we're giving this money to the richest corporations in the history of commerce. Absolutely shocking. As I said, we're doing that because of politics, the legalized bribery that goes on in Washington, D.C. Not to say any of our elected officials here would know anything about that, because I'm sure the system is very different in Canada, but especially our enlightened officials that are with us tonight. But the other part of that equation, as I mentioned before, is lies. The oil and auto industry have been lying to us for decades. And it's interesting that in the 1920s and 30s, when General Motors was looking at the fact that more people took public transit than were taking motorized transit, personal motorized transit cars, and they decided they wanted to amp up their market share. And they went to Standard Oil of New Jersey, which is now ExxonMobil, and they went to Firestone Tire, who made tires, obviously, for General Motors products, and they created a company called National City Lines. And National City Lines went out and methodically bought up the electric rail mass transit systems in 45 American cities and scrapped that clean electric light rail system in every one of those cities and replaced it with dirty diesel buses that were less efficient, dirtier, more costly to operate, but obviously which used their products. In 1947, the administration of President Truman figured this out. And the Justice Department sued those conspirators and found them guilty in federal court of conspiring to monopolize the sale of buses and to take away this mass transit choice for millions of Americans. Unfortunately, even though the courts ruled and it was upheld on appeal, the judge decided that there was really nothing that could be done about it because by that point, in all those 45 cities, they had scrapped the rail cars, burned them in many cases. In Los Angeles, they dumped them in the Pacific Ocean off of the Santa Monica Pier as fish habitat. And in most cases, they had ripped up the tracks to make sure nobody could put down light rail again at taxpayers' expense and repaved the streets at taxpayers' expense with asphalt purchased from oil companies. So we live with the legacy of that conspiracy to this day, with the diesel-powered buses, and obviously one of the choices that then many Americans made when their light rail and their mass transit was taken away was to buy cars and get on freeways. And we live with the legacy of that to this day. And you might say, well, they got caught with their hand in the cookie jar. They were convicted in federal court. At least it was a moral victory that that they were stopped and this behavior was exposed. That was in 1955 by the time the appeals were exhausted. So they were reformed. These companies would never do anything like that again since 1955, right? Well, not exactly. In 1955, the tobacco companies of the world were under increasing pressure from regulators and public health authorities. And they issued what they called a frank statement. They admitted that what was coming out of cigarettes might be causing some kind of harm. And they said, we're going to check our competition at the door on this one issue. All the tobacco companies will get together, we'll compare science, we'll work on our products to make sure that they're safe when used as directed. And the record shows they formed the Tobacco Institute to do the exact opposite, to lie to regulators, to lie to the public, to continue to manipulate the amount of nicotine in cigarettes, and to keep many millions of Americans, Canadians, and others hooked on their products, ultimately killing millions of their best customers. Well, also in 1955, under increasing pressure from regulators about what was coming out of tailpipes, car companies got together, and they issued what they called their frank statement, and they said, well, all right, maybe some harmful emissions are coming out of our tailpipes of our cars. But we don't think so. But if there is, we're going to check our competition at the door on this one issue. We're going to all band together, and we're going to compare science, and we're going to share technology. And we think that if there is anything wrong, we can engineer it out of our cars within 1 year. But we're going to work together on this, and they formed the Automobile Alliance to do that. The record shows they actually formed the Automobile Alliance to do the exact opposite, to lie to the public, to lie to regulators, to hide the truth about the science of what was coming out of their tailpipes, and ultimately to use that alliance to fight off improvements in their own products like catalytic converters and improvements in corporate average fuel economy standards and other efficiencies, to fight off electric car, the zero-emission vehicle mandate. Many of you may have seen the Who Killed the Electric Car movie. I document that in the book as well. Time after time, year after year, all the way up to the present day, car companies, very often working hand in glove with oil companies, have fought, lied, and clawed their way to protect their products and to keep you from using anything else. So when I compare oil and auto companies to tobacco companies, I don't do so lightly, because the chemical composition of what comes out of a tailpipe is remarkably similar to what comes out of a cigarette. And the harms are remarkably similar. And the corporate behavior that delivered those products and those harms and kept us addicted to them is remarkably similar. So in the book, I talk about a solution. And the solution has two parts. The first part is what government must do. And I believe that governments all around the world ought to treat oil and auto companies the way we treated tobacco companies. Take them to court. Make them disgorge some of their astonishing profits and put it back in the pockets of taxpayers in your country and in mine, for health care costs, environmental cleanup costs, and the other costs of dealing with the harms of their products. And you might say, well, Terry, wait a minute. I mean, it's easy to find a jury of 12 people who don't smoke, but how are you going to find a jury of 12 people who don't use cars or don't rely on petroleum in some way? Well, I think people are smarter than that. In fact, a jury in California recently found that gasoline was a defective product because of the way it operates and because of the way it leaks out of underground storage tanks and polluted the groundwater around Lake Tahoe in California. And they held the oil companies responsible for making that defective product. And last September, the Attorney General of California filed a lawsuit against the six major automakers and said that they were guilty of creating a nuisance called global warming, and that even though their products might be legal to sell and to operate, nonetheless, it's a nuisance. It's no different than if Joe's Barbecue opens up a restaurant next to your home, he has a permit to do it, it's zoned for a restaurant, and he stokes up that barbecue to make those southern baby back ribs, and the smoke comes into your windows every single night. That's a nuisance. He's operating with a permit, he's operating lawfully, but he doesn't have the right to create that nuisance under American law or under Canadian law. It's a common law around the world that's recognized. So the Californians are using common law nuisance to say, you can't do that. And if you do, you're going to be held accountable. And so the Attorney General of California has sued those six major automakers seeking compensation for the costs that California is now bearing to deal with climate change. And I'm not talking about the billions that we've identified we're probably losing in terms of crop damage and water damage damage to our water supply and to our public health and so forth. I'm just talking about the tens of millions that we are currently spending to develop responses to the climate crisis and the people we have to hire to develop programs and to implement those programs. That alone costs California tens of millions of dollars in government operations and government programs. And so that's what the Attorney General is seeking to recover, not because we want to stop there, but because we want to set that precedent, and we believe the courts will do it. And once that happens, just like the lawsuits against tobacco, I think every state, province, and country in this world can go after the oil and auto companies and say, you've created this nuisance, we need compensation, just compensation for the health care costs, the environmental cleanup costs, and the cost of dealing with climate change. And in doing so, we can force these companies to civilize themselves. I'm not trying to put oil and auto companies out of business, despite the scathing indictment in this book. I want to civilize them. I want to see oil companies produce biofuels and hydrogen and clean alternative fuels to power our future. I want to see car companies produce the vehicles that will run on those clean alternative fuels to give us a clean, healthy alternative future so that we can live like the Hopi someday and not down the perilous path of Easter Island. But that's the first part. That's what government ought to do, although we all have a part in that, in advocating for those kinds of strategies.
You are listening to Terry Tamminen, the author of Lives Per Gallon, The True Cost of Our Oil Addiction, on the Local Brown Bagger, CFRO 102.7, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
But the other part is up to us. Whether it's solving global warming or whether it's solving our oil addiction, and of course the two are very closely related, it's going to be up to us. It's going to be up to our individual action to tell these companies that we want change, to demand alternative fuels, to start buying them when they're available, to start buying flex fuel vehicles and go back to battery electrics. And even I drive a Honda that's powered by natural gas. You might say, well, that's a fossil fuel. Yes, but we're getting a growing percentage of it from bio natural gas, meaning taking organic waste and converting that into methane that can be used to power our cars. Now, that creates some greenhouse gases, but it's exponentially cleaner than petroleum. It's a great interim fuel. And there's lots of other types of alternative fuels that even today we can be demanding and using in our vehicles. But it's going to be up to us to do that. Now, it's not practical for everyone. We couldn't convert the entire fleet of Canada or the United States overnight to biofuels or to hydrogen or to natural gas. So for those of us that are still stuck in our petroleum-powered vehicles, even if they're SUVs, there's a lot of things we can do to strike a blow for energy independence and for kicking the oil addiction. Tonight, if you have a car in the parking lot, stop by a gas station that has an air pump and check the inflation on your tires. If you can't do it tonight, do it tomorrow. And do it about once a month. Why? Because most people don't. And the result is tires that are just a little bit flat consume 2-3% more petroleum, more gasoline, because of that extra friction as you're driving down the road. So you can reduce your oil consumption by 2-3% just by keeping your tires inflated. That's not too hard. When you get out on the open highway, instead of doing 65 or 75, if you do 55 or 60, that extra 10 or 15 miles an hour that gets you to your destination a few minutes earlier costs you between 15 and 20% of your fuel economy. So just by going that little bit slower, you can save 15 or 20% of the fuel you're consuming. If you avoid jackrabbit starts when you're at the stoplight and then you start up your car, if you don't use your air conditioner in the summer quite as much, there's a few very simple tips that you can use to get 15 to 20% better gas mileage. And of course, if you took public transit or telecommuted or simply got out of your car at least a day a week or a day a month, you could cut your petroleum use even more. The tips are in the book. The references and the websites are in the book. You don't have to own a Prius to strike a blow for energy independence and for kicking the oil addiction. You can do these things. And imagine if everybody over the next week went ahead and did those things, all of us collectively, we could kick our oil addiction by 10 or 20% literally overnight, driving the same things we're driving. And that's a big step forward. We could also send a message, as I said, by moving to what's next. And certainly when you buy a new vehicle, if you think about the most energy-efficient one, fuel-efficient one, in whatever category you have to drive, Maria Shriver, married to Arnold Schwarzenegger, of course, said to me one day, she said, "Terry, will people think I'm a bad person because I drive a Cadillac Escalade?" And I said to her, Maria, how many people on average are with you when you drive that Cadillac Escalade? Because she has four kids and a security detail. She said, "Well, never less than four people and sometimes as many as six." I said, "Well, Maria, you can drive a bus as long as you're not alone. There's nothing wrong with the SUV. It's when, you know, a little 110-pound woman gets in the SUV to drive to the supermarket. There's a little something wrong with that. But, you know, but take the electric car when that happens, because she actually has one. But the fact is, it's not about vilifying SUVs or what we drive. It's the way we use them. So the next time you get a vehicle, you trade up for your personal use or your business, if you get that one that's more fuel efficient in whatever class you need, that's the next blow for energy independence and for kicking our oil addiction. And then, of course, evolving to what's next. And I talk in the book about hydrogen a great deal. Your premier has talked about the hydrogen highway and linking it up all the way from Baja, California, all the way up the 5 corridor through three American states up here to BC. So we'll have a hydrogen highway BC to BC. We're going to try to power that on renewable energy to create the hydrogen so that we don't go from one problem into another. We want to make sure the hydrogen is made from clean, renewable resources as we power the hydrogen highway. But today we have 30 operating hydrogen stations in California and several hundred vehicles. And this year we'll be leasing, both Honda and BMW will be leasing hydrogen-powered vehicles to ordinary consumers. And by 2010, all of the major automakers will be doing so, at least in California. So by the time you have the Olympics here, and we might want to have people be able to drive all the way up the West Coast on hydrogen, they will be able to do it. They'll be able to rent or lease those vehicles, and they'll have a network of fueling stations to power it. We can do this. We have enough renewable resources not only to kick our petroleum habit, but to kick our greenhouse gas habit. People say to me, "Well, come on, Terry, look, we're always going to be somewhat beholden to fossil fuels. We can use less. Let's have a hybrid. Let's have a plug-in hybrid. Let's get 100 miles a gallon." And my answer is no. Would you tell a heroin addict that if he just uses half as much, he's going to be okay? I don't think so. And the same thing is true here. We've got to kick this addiction 100%. There's enough sunlight that falls on the earth in an hour to power all human energy needs for a year. There's more than enough biomass out here and tidal power and wave power, sun power, wind power to power all of your needs and, in fact, to power a lot of our needs in California. And throughout the country, we can take these renewable resources, whether it's agricultural waste or urban green waste or other biomass or wind or solar, and we can absolutely convert our entire electric and transportation energy system to run on renewables. And when people tell me, "Yeah, we could, there's no technological barriers, but it's too expensive," I remind them that we're actually paying about $10 a gallon for gasoline. We just don't pay it all at the pump. And the same thing is true with coal-fired generation that we've subsidized for decades and nuclear power that we've subsidized for decades, and which poses tremendous threats, obviously, to our safety. So we don't need to depend on these technologies of the past. We can look to the future. It's all in our hands, but it's going to take our political will to do it. It's going to take us making these individual choices. And I know when I say that I'm preaching to the choir, because I'll bet there's more Prius owners in this crowd than in any crowd of another 130 people we can go find anywhere out on the street. But that's where all of us come in, is to teach others how to do the same. Not preach, teach. Teach them how to make more fuel-efficient vehicles out of what they've got, how to take fewer trips, how to reduce their greenhouse gas footprint, how to know what their greenhouse gas footprint is in the first place, how to support leaders when they say, "I'm going to reduce greenhouse gases." When you have a premier who in his throne speech says, "I'm committed to do the same kinds of level of greenhouse gas reductions as other civilized states and provinces and nations of the world. And he means it, and he'll do it. But he'll only do it with your help. If you demand the same of the rest of your elected leaders, if you make sure that that's the litmus test when you go into the voting booth, if you make sure that your own personal behavior matches what you're demanding of your elected leaders, and if you help others do the same. Because that's the real question, and that's the real way we will kick this oil addiction and make this a day to remember. I think I'm asking you tonight to walk out of here committed to a couple of simple things. First of all, if we reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, by definition, we're going to have to kick this oil habit. We can't possibly get to the kinds of reductions that have been talked about by our scientists and still depend on petroleum or coal. So let's measure everything in terms of greenhouse gases, because it's a simple way to look at it and to measure our collective progress on these issues, not just on oil. And the scientists have told us, and when I was Secretary of EPA and I had to recommend reduction targets for Governor Schwarzenegger, went to the scientists and I said, all right, so what is it we have to reduce if we want to avoid the worst of the climate change problems? And they said, we've got to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions about 80%, by the year 2050 and get below 1990 levels by the year 2020 as a path up to that 2050 goal. And if we can do those things, and then obviously other jurisdictions around the country and around the world do likewise, we can probably get to within a predictable range of impacts and a manageable range of impacts and avoid the worst of the impacts. So let's walk out of here tonight making this our personal commitment, that we are going to hold all of our elected officials accountable, we're going to hold ourselves accountable to a reduction of greenhouse gases of about a third by 2020. That gets you below 1990 levels, so about a third by 2020, and 80% by 2050. And that we're going to support the various measures that will get us there. We're going to support the elected leaders that have the plan to get us there. If we make that our shared understanding, and if we go out and help others to understand it, because it's complex, make no mistake about it, we will kick the oil addiction, and we will have a future that looks more like the Hopi than that of Easter Island. And we know we can do these things. As I said, the technology is there, the renewable resources are there. But the real question is, who among us will be the first to say that I can do with a little less, that my children will have a little more? Who among us will be the first to say that my life will not only be measured by the number on the bottom of a balance sheet, but by the balance of clean air and clean water and healthy landscapes that I bequeath to my children? And who among us will be the first to answer the call to action that rang out across the United States four decades ago when a president of the United States challenged Americans to ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country? Well, that's a pretty good question in any country, in any language. So what I'm here asking you as Canadians, as fellow citizens to do tonight, fellow North Americans, as friends, as people of economies that are very similar, that are tied together in so many ways, is help us, help your elected officials, help your utilities, help your oil companies. They need the help, trust me. Help your auto companies, help your mass transit systems. Help all of us kick this oil addiction. And let's measure it in terms of our greenhouse gas reductions and solve the climate crisis. And if we walk out of here tonight with that shared understanding, then we will make this a day to remember. But the shared understanding has got to go beyond knowing the numbers of climate change and how many people get sick because of oil addiction. It's got to be the understanding that every one of us will make a difference. And if we don't join this fight, that will make a difference too. Or as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, anyone can be great because anyone can serve. You don't need a college degree. Your verb and your subject need not agree. You only need a heart full of grace. Well, if this is the night we agree with that admonition, if this is the night we act upon it, and if this is the night we teach it to others, then this will be a day to remember. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for being concerned. Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech given April the 4th, 2007, at the Vancouver Museum by Terry Tamminen. Now, I'm going to spell his name so that you can find him on the net. It's Terry, T-E-R-R-Y, T-A-M-M-I-N-E-N. TammenIn. So you can find him at www.terrytammenin.com. Audio for this speech was provided by J. Marty Smith Production Services and recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock for CFRO Radio in Vancouver. If you missed the speech, you can download it from the Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. Look for the Climate Change section in the Audio on Demand menu. There you will also find the question and answer period that followed this speech, which had some very interesting comments from the audience and answers from Terry Tamminen. Be sure to join us every Tuesday for the best speeches of Vancouver on the local Brown Bagger. And you are listening to CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver. We're going to close out today with the one and only Tina Turner from the Earth Justice album singing, "A Change Is Gonna Come."
Please.